Hello and welcome to the Litigation Podcast presented by Blackstone Chambers. Join our barristers as they discuss their expertise on trending topics and debates in the legal sector. If you want to be part of the discussion, subscribe below to receive our latest episodes.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for coming to our first Blackstone breakfast briefing of the year. Thank you to those who have been braving the weather outside. Thank you for Beth for braving the front row in glorious isolation. Do come and join Beth if you'd like to. She's really nice. Welcome back. I say welcome back to the Blackstone Breakfast Briefing because this is the first one of the year, because during October to February, we take our superstar barristers and we hibernate them away so that they come back really fresh in the spring to give you even more dynamism. And here they are, like three bears, ready to entertain you. Now, notice there are only three of them. If you've been here before, you know, we normally have sort of four or five, but slightly more restricted today. That's not because the rest of them are still asleep downstairs, but it's because Luca Kronianian has been doing some absolutely fantastic work preparing an in-depth analysis of primary, vicarious, and accessory liability in the context of fraud claims. He's taken it on tour with the Commercial Bar Association to great acclaim across continents, and we wanted to give you a bit of a flavour of it. So we did a kind of Goldilocks survey, and a lot of people felt that if we gave you the full 2 hours this morning, that would be too long. But other people thought that if we gave him the usual 5 to 8 minutes and then cut him off, that would be too short. So what we've done is we've given Luca an extended breakfast briefing slot of 20 minutes, and that is just right. He's also learned how to use slides. No one's ever done that on Blackstone Briefing. And he's also caused notepads to be placed on everyone's seats for the first time. And I'm not quite sure why, but maybe you're going to get a test at the end of it. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up, Luca.
Thank you very much, Andy. Thank you all for coming. The 20 minutes, as Andy says, are a result of a profound negotiation in which I suggested, why don't I spend 2 hours doing a one-man reenactment of a Ponzi scheme and then get audience participation? And Andy came up with several very creative and polite ways of saying, that's a stupid idea, Luca. No, we'll give you 20 minutes instead. Slides, what an exciting thing. What an embrace of technology. So you've heard about all sorts of discussions about law and AI, but we're now using slides. So that shows you where we are in the technological spectrum. To compound the sense of just how cutting edge this is, the beady-eyed amongst you may notice that the title of this talk, and certainly my talk, To Catch a Thief and Their Friends, is a reference to a 1955 film by Alfred Hitchcock. So cutting edge pop culture references. To go alongside the cutting edge use of slides. Anyway, out of interest, has anyone here actually seen the film To Catch a Thief? Okay, very good. This will make slightly more sense to you. A few moments and some of the slides that the rest of you see will be slightly confusing until I explain them. So what I am going to talk to you about is the scenario where you have a clear and strong claim in fraud against one defendant. Let's call them the fraudster, the primary wrongdoer. But there are various other parties, including people and entities, with varying degrees of proximity to or involvement in the fraud. And the question is, to what extent and how can those potential other parties be made liable to a claimant? And I'm going to talk in particular about the following four avenues and the following four things to consider in that sort of situation. First, primary liability through attribution. It's a topic that is often glossed over, but I'm going to invite you in that section of the talk to really pause and think about it and consider some exciting new principles that are about to be debated at appellate level. Second, I'm going to talk about vicarious liability. Third, I will talk about accessory liability. And fourth, unlawful means conspiracy. And I'll consider how that interlocks with these other interesting topics. So it's not just to catch a thief and their friends. It's to catch a thief, their company, their boss, and their friends. But lest that all seem entirely claimant focused, the lessons that we're going to learn together are equally important to any of us who represent defendants. And as Professor Paul Davies put it in a recent article about accessory liability, there must be limits to the extent to which claimants can be permitted to go defendant shopping. And one of the trends that I boldly anticipate happening in the next few years is that following, in particular, Lord Leggett's seminal judgment in Lifestyle Equities on Accessory Liability, a case which I'll talk about in part three, there are going to be some moves towards making sure that claimants are not overstepping the boundaries or overextending the boundaries of liability. So perhaps this will explain why you have these notepads available. In order to try and keep this abstract discussion of principles grounded, I'm going to talk you through a case study derived from two actual cases that I've been involved in recently. And this is where the Hitchcock fans will feel very smug because they'll understand what's about to happen. This is our case study. This is our primary fraudster, our wrongdoer. Let's call her Grace. Grace is an officer of two companies, Riviera Holdings and Riviera Investments Limited. Holdings is the topco in the group, and Investments is the company that is primarily concerned with contracting with clients or customers of the investment management business. Grace picks a target to deceive. The target is called Carey, and he is pictured here at the exact moment that he realized he'd been defrauded. Grace tells Carey lies. She deceives him. She sends him an email which represents or makes certain representations about the levels of returns that they have achieved for clients in recent years. And those figures are inflated. She knows that they're inflated. She deliberately misrepresents in order to get him to invest or to contract with Riviera Investments. And remember that the contract is with Riviera Investments. We need a third and final character for our case study, and he's going to be a director of the companies. So we are going to call him Alfred. And Alfred is a director of both Holdings and Investments. Alfred does not interact with Carey directly in any way, shape, or form. He doesn't say anything to him. He doesn't make any representations by words or by conduct. But before Grace sent her deceitful email, she sent a draft of it to Alfred. And subsequent to that draft being sent to Alfred, the draft was changed. And those fraudulent figures, those inflated returns, increased. The percentages went up. They became more attractive. That's our evidential pattern. So now let's dive into some legal principles and consider how we might apply them. So part one, an attribution. Attribution is the process of legal reasoning by which the knowledge and conduct of persons, natural persons, are treated as those of entities. So said Lord Walker in the case of Moulin Global Eye Care Trading in the Hong Kong Final Court of Appeal. And that is one of the excellently pithy statements of principle that is often very useful to trot out when you're dealing with issues of attribution. In many cases, we don't really even think about attribution because we see an obvious scenario in which someone is acting as an officer, director, or other employee or agent of a company, and attribution is treated as a foregone conclusion. But sometimes pausing and thinking about it can yield some potential new avenues. There is no single hard and fast, one-size-fits-all test for attribution. And many of you, I'm sure, will know the judgment of Lord Hoffman in the Meridian Global case, in which he said the court must fashion a test for attribution fit for the purpose and context for which the court is seeking to attribute. Just to unpack that a little bit, if an outsider to a company like our Carey is bringing a claim against the company, and you're considering whether the fraudulent actions of an officer of the company are to be attributed to that company, that's a very different consideration to if the company or shareholders, by way of an action in respect of the company, are bringing a claim against Grace, in which circumstances you obviously wouldn't want Grace to have the benefit of a limitation defense, which enables her to say, well, I had knowledge that I was committing fraud, therefore the company had knowledge that I was committing fraud, and that was all 7 years ago, and therefore you cannot sue me. When you're trying to fashion these specific rules on a case-by-case basis for attribution, Lord Hoffman tells us that there are three conventional sources that you draw from. Number one, the constitution of the company. What does the constitution say about the allocation of powers and authority and how they can be exercised by the organs of the company? Number two, you have company law. And company law not only gives us principles concerning formal or de jure directors, but it also gives us principles concerning de facto and shadow directors, which we may be able to draw from as a basis for saying there should be attribution on the facts of a given case. And thirdly and finally, there is the law of agency, which allows us to identify circumstances in which an entity has conferred authority, perhaps impliedly, perhaps without a formal document, upon certain individuals to act as or on behalf of the company. So you consider all three of those sources and then come back to the question of whether or not attribution would serve the purpose or policy of the law in question. So in our case, would it serve the policy of the law of deceit, the law concerning fraudulent misrepresentations? And in the third case mentioned on the slide, McNicholas, Lord Dyson, then at first instance, very pithily said, you always need to consider whether or not policy of the law at question is going to be served by your decision to attribute or not. So attribution is not just a dry mechanical exercise of going through constitution, company law, and agency law, but there's a consideration of purpose. So in many cases, the exercise that I've just talked through will be enough to help you identify who gets the deceit attributed to it. But what do you do when the fraudster is someone capable of wearing many hats, if they are a director of multiple companies, multiple entities, whether that's multiple entities within a single group, or perhaps even separate and entirely unrelated entities? You need to engage in this question of capacity. In what capacity were they acting? Or as it's sometimes put, which hat or hats were they wearing? And in my opinion, unknown but valuable judgment is this case of Smithton and Nagar, in which Lady Justice Arden, as she was then, gave some guidance, the thrust of which is that capacity or hat wearing is a question of fact that you decide taking into account all the circumstances of the case, including, importantly, how the entity was historically governed. So if an entity did not conduct itself in a particularly formal way with board meetings and board resolutions in order for certain powerful individuals to go about and take decisions that bound the company should not be able to rely on the absence of, let's say, a board minute or a resolution authorizing a particular course of conduct in order to say, well, the director wasn't acting in their capacity as a director. And finally, I'm going to do the sort of classic barrister thing of talking about a case that I was involved in, a case called Jaffa and Abraj Holdings, a judgment of the Grand Court of the Cayman Islands at present, which was handed down in July last year, and which is going on appeal to the Cayman Islands Court of Appeal later this year in June. You heard it here first. It is, on any analysis, going to be a very interesting judgment on a number of issues in fraud law, including in relation to what Grant's going to talk about, but also in relation to attribution. The Abraj litigation, many of you will be familiar with in some capacity or another. It's a topic that I could genuinely spend 2 hours talking about and indeed reenacting, if they would let me. suffice to say this, there was a fraudster who was the founder and ultimate controller of a group of entities, and he committed a fraud to get my client to pay over loans. And the loans were intended for multiple groups in the company, at least 4. But the loan contracts were only entered into by 2 of the companies in this group. And so the question was, is the fraud to be attributed just to those 2 companies, the contracting entities, or can you and should you attribute to the various other entities for whose benefit these loans were taken out, even if they were not parties to the contract? And at first instance, the judge decided that you should take the more restrictive approach. It's only the contracting counterparties that assumed responsibility to repay the loans. Therefore, the deceit that was involved in procuring the loans should be attributed only to them. Our argument, I'm not revealing any state secrets here, it's the subject of a notice of appeal. Our argument is that that was a wrongful approach of the principles of attribution. So keep your eyes peeled. In our case study involving Grace and Riviera and the 2 Riviera companies, all of this means you should certainly be arguing that the fraud is to be attributed to investments. But there's also a potential basis for arguing that the fraud should be attributed to holdings if you have some evidence that she was purporting to act or acting in a capacity to achieve holdings' mandate if Holdings, for example, in some way indicated that it was seeking to raise funds, it was seeking to get more people investing and contracting with its subsidiary. Finally, on the topic of primary liability, I'm just going to flag the concept of manifest approval and adoption. This is basically what happens where somebody does not make a representation, somebody else does, but the original person approves of or adopts the representation made by another with knowledge of the facts that make it a misrepresentation. And this is a principle or a doctrine that has become increasingly debated, including in the trilogy of cases that are up on the slide. I won't go into the detail of any of them. But there are two important considerations. Silence generally is insufficient. So going back to our case study, let's say Alfred is copied to the email in which Grace tells lies to the putative investor, the putative customer. The fact that he's copied and says nothing to correct her misrepresentation is unlikely to be enough, absent some pre-existing duty of disclosure. And the second important consideration is that the representee must receive the approval. The manifest approval or adoption must be communicated to them somehow. So if in our scenario, if Alfred emailed Grace privately and said, thank you so much for sending that email, that's absolutely fantastic, I agree with everything that you've said, what a wonderful job you're doing, that will not be enough for manifest approval and adoption. Let's turn now to vicarious liability, part two of the talk. Vicarious liability, the courts have always been at pains to emphasize, is distinct from attribution. Attribution is about primary liability. If you attribute, you are saying this entity committed the fraud. Vicarious liability is different. You are not saying that the entity itself committed the fraud, but in essence, for reasons of policy sculpted by the law over many, many years, the company is liable or responsible because its agent or its employee, someone that it put out there in the world to conduct its business, committed a fraud. The simple and first take home on vicarious liability, known I'm sure to many of you, is that the test in deceit or the test in reliance-based torts for vicarious liability is different to the general common law test for vicarious liability. You may remember cases from sort of studies and various things that you've learned over the years about assaults outside nightclubs and car parks and so on, in which the general test at common law for vicarious liability is that there's an employer-employee relationship and the tort is committed in circumstances sufficiently closely connected with that relationship. And generally, that will lead to the imposition of vicarious liability. In the fraud context, in the deceit context, the test is more stringent. There needs to be actual or ostensible authority, and the fraud must be committed within the scope of that authority. But it can be ostensible authority. So if the holding company or some other company other than a contracting entity has in some way made some kind of holding out that this person speaks for them or is authorized to act on their behalf, that can be your hook, and that can be the way that vicarious liability comes in, even if attribution is not available. And a couple of helpful cases in relation to vicarious liability are Ivy and Martin and Bell and ClearCourse, both of which confirm that it is generally not open to a defendant to say, we authorized this person to conduct negotiations, but we did not authorize them to commit fraud. It is enough, as Mr. Justice Henshaw put it in the former of these two cases, that the fraud was committed in the course of negotiations, which were within the authority of the agent. Accessory liability. The judgment of Lord Leggett in Lifestyle Equities is coming up on 2 years old now. It is a fantastic judgment and well worth revisiting. And it, among many other things, gives us some very valuable insights into accessory liability, and in particular, the concepts of procuring a tort and torts committed pursuant to common design, those being two methods or modes of accessory liability. So just by way of a very brief recap, I'm going to take you away from the world of the Riviera and into the world of the Beverly Hills Polo Club. This was a logo, the trademark to which was owned by the claimants in the Lifestyle Equities case. And the following was a logo that was owned by the defendant companies that were originally the first and second defendants to the claim of the Santa Monica Polo Club. Now, I'm not a patent lawyer, but I wasn't totally surprised to hear that there was an issue here. And breach of patent is a form of strict liability. And so the claimants in the Lifestyle Equities case said, at first instance and throughout, liability of the company that is putting about this logo is strict. And therefore, by the same token, the directors of this company, who are family members, those directors are also liable as accessories on a strict basis. And we do not need to prove that they had any particular knowledge in order for them to be strictly liable as accessories, because the primary mode of liability is strict and does not involve a knowledge test. And the Supreme Court rejected that. And the sort of pithy takeaway from lifestyle equities, if there is one, is that where accessory liability for torts is concerned, there is a test of knowledge for accessory liability to be imposed. And that test is that the accessory must have knowledge of the essential facts that make up the tort. They don't need to know the legal consequences. They don't need to know that what they're doing or what they are helping to happen is a fraud, or indeed any kind of a breach of the law. There is no subjective test in which you're required as a claimant to show that the accessory knew that they were an accessory to a fraud, that they were helping or facilitating a fraud. But there needs to be knowledge of those essential facts. So in the case of a fraudulent misrepresentation, knowledge of a representation, knowledge of its falsity, and perhaps also knowledge that it was intended by that representation to induce the victim, Carey in our case. To briefly unpack the two principal modes of accessory liability that we'll be interested in, first you have this concept of procuring, and there's basically a two-part test for that. A procures somebody else, B, to do something, and that amounts to a tort. And second, A has knowledge of the essential facts which make the act a tort. Commonly, you have procuring in situations where encouragement is given, instructions are given, or indeed the very act of conferring authority, authorizing someone to engage in particular negotiations, can itself be a form of procuring. And as I've summarized in the cases at the final bullet point there, you see a very clear trend in the case law of a recognition that a company director may be liable for procuring their company to commit a fraud in those sorts of ways that I've just summarized. Common design is distinct, but it shares the same fundamental test with respect to knowledge. Three parts to the core test here. A performs an act which assists B to commit a tort. A has knowledge of the essential facts which make B's act a tort. And three, A and B are acting pursuant to a common design. And it's that third and final limb which is in some ways the most interesting one. Because what level of communication do you need for a common design? What level of agreement do you need to have? Obviously, in some cases, we will be able at some point in the proceedings to get, hopefully, helpful WhatsApp messages and emails that reveal a high level of coordination. But you certainly don't have that at the very early stages, and perhaps you'll never have that, because not all fraudsters are kind enough to leave a clear evidential trail. One very interesting example given by Lord Leggett in his lifestyle equities judgment is the example of two people who are rowing a boat. Each of them has one oar. And those two people don't need to speak with one another in order to get to a point where they're rowing simultaneously. They don't need to speak to one another or have any particular in-depth discussion in order to be acting pursuant to a common design. Now, that's a very pithy and straightforward example. The real world is rarely so straightforward. But what I think it reflects and what you can see in some of the case law, and certainly I've got some upcoming cases where there are debates about this, is that you can have a situation where two people who are in different companies or perhaps not close colleagues effectively both realize what's happening. They both realize that representations are being made. One of them realizes that the information that they are giving to the other is fraudulent, is false, and is going to be used for a deceitful purpose. There's no great discussion about it. There is no classic plotting of a conspiracy or hatching a conspiracy. But nonetheless, at least arguably, there has been a common design there. And finally, I'm just going to recap, to the joy of all, the wonderful test of unlawful means conspiracy, which requires a combination between two or more parties, an intention to injure, which need not be the predominant intention. You can, of course, have conspirators who are acting principally for their own commercial benefit. But they foresee, and more than foresee, they realize that as a means to their end, they will be harming somebody else's interests. They will be injuring them. Third, concerted action pursuant to the combination. and fourth, the involvement of unlawful means, which of course can comprise fraudulent representations, can be breaches of foreign law, can be breaches of trust or fiduciary duty. What, if any, role does the great and glorious and long-standing unlawful means conspiracy tort, which has served so many people applying for freezing injunctions as argument number four as to why we have a good arguable case, what role does it play? Well, it is up for debate, and there is an article by Paul Davies and Philip Sales writing Extrajudicially from 2018, which suggests there is no real role for this tort at all. And in a world where I think judges are getting increasingly alive to the fact that unlawful means conspiracy is often the kitchen sink being thrown in as part and parcel of a fraud claim, you might want to pause and consider whether you need, either as a matter of full and frank disclosure, to raise the limitations of this claim and the potential for an argument that it doesn't add anything, doesn't take you beyond where you would be by way of accessory liability, but also consider whether or not you need it at all. For the time being, it is still its own tort, and it is a method of getting primary liability established against the conspirators. I've heard some people suggest that the value of unlawful means conspiracy as contrasted with accessory liability is that it's more apt to capture what I've heard referred to as pure planners, people who don't actually do the act of procuring somebody else to commit the fraud, people who don't send the instructions, people who don't necessarily do something that assists somebody else to commit the fraud, but people who are involved in the hatching of the scheme. Whether or not that is a sound distinction between the two remains to be seen and decided. So that is all. Thank you for enduring this 20 minutes discussion. I'm going to apologize in advance. Unfortunately, I need to leave very shortly due to another appointment. I'm very sorry to my co-speakers for that, but thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much, Luca. You all look very fresh and engaged. We've got through our marathon session. Thank you very much indeed.
Fun stuff now.
Case of the quarter. You'll remember the stop. We take two exciting cases from the last quarter here at Blackstone and tell you about them. And the Brazilian dam case, or La Municipio de Mariana and BHP and Vale, was one of the biggest cases, if not the biggest case ever brought in the English courts. And here at Blackstone, we had a little extra internal frisson because we were on both sides of it. And everyone knew that whoever won would get to speak at the Blackstone breakfast briefing. Yeah. That gave a little extra edge to their battles in court. But here we are. We're off to South America. And as we have a bear-themed breakfast briefing, I'll say playing the role of Paddington for us today is the claimant's successful advocate, Antonia Eklund.
Thank you, Andy. Yes, unfortunately, no one else on the other side is here to take any difficult questions this morning. but we did have a stellar lineup: Shahid Fatima, Casey, Victoria Windle, Casey, David Lowe, recently appointed Casey, and Daniel Burgess. So that was fun seeing them in court along the way. I do apologise in advance for my cough. I hope you can hear me and that I don't have to ask Grant to take over at some point. but yes, I'm going to give a brief overview of the first stage trial, which was 6 months, and the judgment handed down in November, and then some points on the even longer second stage trial coming up that's just been listed for April next year. So the first stage was dealing with issues of liability and limitation. And as I said, in November, Mrs. Justice O'Farrell handed down her 222-page judgment. And in this judgment, BHP was found liable on two bases, strict liability and fault-based liability. Under strict liability, this is our primary claim, BHP was found to be liable under the Brazilian environmental law, which implements the polluter pays principle. I think notably for commercial parties, BHP was not the operator of the dam. It was the ultimate parent company and owned the operator, Samarco, in a joint venture with Vale. However, under the Brazilian environmental law, Mrs. Justice O'Farrell found that there was no material distinction between direct and indirect polluters, and that in accordance with the Brazilian case law, a parent company or other entity could be found liable, considering factors such as whether it controlled, participated in, funded, and or benefited from the polluting activity. So, this led us on a deep dive into the relationship between BHP and Samarco and the activity. And on a number of bases, Mrs. Justice O'Farrell found that there was a sufficient relationship for there to be responsibility for the activity. This included control of Samarco, including through its corporate governance framework, which meant that BHP was effectively able to ensure its interests were represented on the Samarco board. And this ties in with some of the points that Luca has made about capacity and hat wearing. There was a debate as to whether BHP representatives on the Samarco board were wearing a Samarco hat only, which was BHP's argument, or whether, as it was put on our side, they were wearing the Samarco hat but never took off their BHP jacket. And it was found that they ultimately were appointed by BHP and were able, through that forum, to represent BHP's interests and effectively control Samarco in that way. Similarly, BHP and Vale had representatives on Samarco's subcommittees and committees that were set up by the Samarco board. And in this way, it was found they were able to control and participate in all aspects of the business or significant aspects in relation to the polluting activity. So in relation to risk management, management of the dam, funding decisions, dividend decisions, long and short-term strategies, and also that BHP itself had to approve the expansion projects for Samarco, which included the expansion of the dam. So taking all these factors together, as well as many others, but I won't take you through all of them, it was found that BHP was responsible under the strict liability regime. As to fault-based liability, Mrs. Justice O'Farrell found that in accordance with the Brazilian Civil Code, BHP owed a legal duty to avoid harm caused by an act or omission that was negligent, imprudent, or lacking in skill. BHP owed this duty on the basis of its control over Samarco, so tying into those factors under the strict liability case, assumption of responsibility for risk assessment, management, and control of the tailings dam, and participation in the tailings dam operations. It was then found on the evidence that BHP had been negligent, imprudent, and/or lacking in skill in allowing a number of processes which led to the collapse of the dam. So these included matters relating to inadequate drainage, the failure to carry out certain studies or remediation efforts, and raising the dam in certain conditions. So on limitation, I thought I would show you a fun flowchart we had, which maps out the several overlapping arguments on limitation as they affected different cohorts of claimants. So these included arguments as to whether environmental claims were not subject to prescription, whether their particular rules in relation to indigenous communities, public entities, whether the proceedings in Brazil impacted on the proceedings here. Fortunately for us, Mrs. Justice O'Farrell found that this one worked. So we could stop here and essentially didn't have to go here. That was essentially that criminal proceedings in Brazil had stopped time running altogether for the civil proceedings here, and they did not start running again until 2024. Combined with that, she found that the limitation period was 5 years based on some of the arguments down here, including that victims of an environmental disaster can be treated as equivalent to consumers under the Consumer Defence Code and then come under special rules and a special limitation rule. There's 5 years there. So combining the two, limitation doesn't end until 2029, so more claims could be brought. But that's not the end of these proceedings. There will be a permission hearing next week in the Court of Appeal to determine issues on liability and limitation, whether BHP's appeal on these issues can proceed, including some of these points up here. And then an even longer second stage trial has been listed to commence in April of next year, evidence to finish by Christmas, and then the parties coming back in the following April for closing submissions. So the second stage, just briefly, is to try issues of causation and loss, and will proceed by way of 40 test claimants or lead claimants nominated between the parties. Their claims will be addressed and judgment given either by way of binding determination or by giving guidance in terms of individual assessments and evidential thresholds that can be used to extrapolate out for other claimants. The court will also hear from a range of experts on Brazilian law and on technical disciplines, including ecotoxicology, hydrology, geochemistry, or geology. And the court has also granted a sort of hybrid direction on expert evidence, which I think is quite an interesting example of the TCC's quite close case management of big group claims like this. It's also been used in other group claims, such as recent emissions cases, that the parties have permission to instruct experts and to obtain a report, but not yet to rely on that evidence at trial. So there will be further directions given as to this in later CMCs, depending on the issues in the lead claimants' cases once these have crystallized on the individual pleadings, which are in process at the moment. So we thought stage one was long, stage two is even longer, and the proceedings issued back in 2019 are very much not over yet.
Thank you very much, Antonia. And remember, the winner of stage two will be back at Breakfast Briefing next week to tell us all about it. But let's finish today with a trip to the Privy Council, a very important decision on the need or otherwise for subjective awareness of representations in Credit Suisse, Bermuda, and even East Philly. He's one of our most junior tenants. He's making his Blackstone Breakfast Briefing debut today, so playing baby bear for us. Please welcome Grant Nyston.
Thank you. Imagine you're a cab driver. You're hailed down by an individual. You ask them, where do you want to go? They tell you Liverpool Street Station. You pick them up. You drive them there. When you get there, though, they quickly open the door, jump out, don't pay. Bummer. But being a creative and highly litigious cab driver, as I'm sure you would be, you decide to sue the individual who's made a runner in the tort of deceit. And you think, quite rightly, wasn't it a representation, a misrepresentation, when they held up their hand to hail me down, the representation being that they were willing to pay? You write your witness statement, and in your witness statement you say, when you picked up this scoundrel, you would have naturally assumed, without thinking about it, that they had intended to pay for the ride. Now at trial, you're asked in cross-examination, were you consciously aware when you picked up that individual that they had represented that they had intended to pay? You think about it and you say, no, of course not. You're asked, did you consciously reason it out that because there was a hail sign on your cab, that when you picked them up, that the person was representing they had the means and intention to pay? Again, you say, of course not. Your claim in fraudulent misrepresentation has just failed. That was, until last November, the state of the law on the tort of deceit. There was a legal requirement for a claimant to plead and prove that at the time that they acted upon the misrepresentation, they were consciously aware of the representation and understood that it had been made. Now, that is no longer the law. As of November last year, in Lord Leggett's judgment for the Privy Council in Credit Suisse Life and even Ishvili, the Privy Council has found quite stringently and in robust terms that that is no longer a requirement of the English tort of deceit. So I'm going to address how we got here in four steps. First, how we got here in the case, the facts of the case. Second, some brief legal history. Third, Lord Leggett's corrective in the judgment. And finally, where we might go next. So the facts of the case. The claimant was the former Prime Minister of Georgia, Mr. Bidzina Ivanishvili. He is a billionaire, he is an oligarch, and he is now sanctioned by the United States. In 2011, he began discussions with Credit Suisse, and in particular his relationship manager at Credit Suisse, Monsieur Le Cordon, concerning a life insurance policy by which he would pay in premiums under the policies, and the premiums would then be invested in segregated accounts. It was a wealth management scheme. On the advice of Monsieur Le Cordon, Mr. Ivanishvili initially transferred $750 million into the bank. 3 years later, in 2015, came to light that Monsieur Le Cordon had not been entirely honest and had been dealing fraudulently with the assets. He had been misappropriating them, he had transferred them to different clients, he'd been using them to run down losses for other clients, and he'd been investing in products for which he received secret commissions. He was prosecuted for criminal fraud in Switzerland, he was convicted for 5 years, and in 2018 he committed suicide. Mr. Ivanishvili sued CS Life in Bermuda. He claimed damages for breach of contract and for breach of fiduciary duties. That was in 2017. In 2020, he then applied to add a further claim in fraudulent misrepresentation. We'll come back to that. There was a trial of the main action in the Supreme Court of Bermuda in 2021. CS Life lost, $600 million award against it. Appeal up to the Court of Appeal. lost again, but there was a finding that the misrepresentation claim had been mispleaded and should therefore be struck out, and also that it was time-barred. On a final appeal by Wright to the Privy Council, C.S. Life appealed on liability and quantum. Mr. Ivanishvili cross-appealed on his misrepresentation claim. And overall, C.S. Life managed to knock down that damages award by a bit, and Mr. Ivanishvili's cross-appeal failed, and the misrepresentation claim was not revived. So what was this misrepresentation claim? The way that it was pleaded was this. Mr. Ivanishvili said that Monsieur Lacordran, when he recommended the investment to him, had impliedly represented that the bank would not manage the accounts fraudulently. That was the representation. He says those misrepresentations were false. Monsieur Lacordran didn't intend to deal with the assets fraudulently. It was known to be false and was intended to induce Mr. Ivanishvili into investing. The question arose, was Mr. Ivanishvili consciously aware at the time of that representation that Monsieur Lacordran was saying, I won't deal fraudulently with your assets? Now, strangely, that was not alleged by the plaintiffs. Mr. Ivanishvili, even though he had the opportunity to, didn't give evidence on the point. And in cross-examination, he didn't even give evidence that he had assumed that Monsieur Lacordran wouldn't deal with his assets fraudulently. And so it set up almost a perfect test case for the point of legal interest, namely, whether or not conscious awareness is a legal requirement. Supreme Court of Bermuda said no, Court of Appeal said yes, and so we get to the Privy Council. Now, some very brief legal history about why we got here. The conscious awareness requirement frequently appears and has frequently appeared in the last 15 years in lists of the elements of the tort of deceit. The earliest that we were able to find was Mr. Justice Christopher Clark, as he then was, in Rafason in 2011, listing out four elements. He says a defendant has to make representations. The claimant needs to understood that the representations were made. It's the conscious awareness requirement. The representations have to be false, and the claimant has to have been induced by the representations. All standard stuff. And in fact, Rafason was then cited as authority in, I think we found 11 cases for that list of elements. 10 years later, though, the sands had begun to shift, and there were two judgments by Mrs. Justice Cockerell, as she then was, in 2021 and 2023, where she was asked to revisit the principle. Now, she concluded on authority that there was such a requirement, but Mrs. Justice Cockerell was perplexed by, in particular, the cab driver example, or the way it was put to her. It was an auctioneer and a bidder. A bidder holding up a paddle is impliedly representing that they are willing to pay for the item. Her view was that there was a peculiar type of case, like the cab driver or like the paddle bearer, where the representation was simple, it could well be missed by the claimant, but it was at the heart of the transaction. And in those cases, awareness was so trivial, that it was so obvious, that it really didn't need to be pleaded or proved at all. But it was still a requirement. So you had to put it in your pleading, you had to put a single sentence in the witness statement saying it was so obvious that it had to be assumed. And then she contrasted that with complex transactions where that wouldn't work. You'd have to actually plead and prove it properly. Now, by the time we get to the Privy Council, Lord Leggett has clearly read Mrs. Justice Cockerell's judgments and he did not agree with them. He had taken strong views about the matter. It's quite clear if you watch it back that he had been thinking about this for a long time. He viewed the cross-appeal as a prime opportunity to get the Lord Leggett view of the world out in public. So he addresses the point at substantial length of the judgment. He stresses it in terms that, quite frankly, were not the way that it was put by either party in the Privy Council. And he addressed it even though, first, it was technically academic. The misrepresentation claim was always going to fail. It was time-barred. And in fact, we got all our costs of the cross-appeal. So it was never going to be relevant. And it was in the Privy Council, so he didn't make a Willis and Joyce direction that it's binding on the English courts. He just did this for fun. But it will, to be clear, be treated as authoritative by the English courts. Writing the judgment for the board, Lord Leggett said that he had no hesitation in, quote, rejecting the theory, which has gained some currency following the dicta in Rafason, the contemporaneous awareness and understanding of the representation is, in law, an essential element of a deceit claim. Now, to get there, he identified four misconceptions about the tort of deceit that he says has generated this false understanding of how the tort works. And I'll run through them quickly, but they each show something quite interesting about how deceit works. Misconception number one, that the claimant needs to be aware of a representation before they can rely on it. Lord Leggett says, not so. Lord Leggett says, reliance is in two parts. There's reliance in belief, that is, that the representation caused the claimant to hold the false belief, and reliance in action, that the claimant held the belief and acted to suffer loss. So in the cab driver example, the representation, hailing the cab, caused the claimant to hold a false belief, namely that the passenger would pay, but it doesn't matter that the cab driver didn't think about that at the time. It was sufficient that because that belief was formed that the person would pay, that the cab driver took them to their destination. That's fine, Lord Leggett says. Misconception number two, that it's always necessary to establish that the claimant had understood the words to convey a particular meaning, and therefore, obviously, you have to be aware of them. Again, not so, Lord Leggett says. It's not a requirement of the cause of action to prove a particular meaning. It will only be necessary in certain factual circumstances, namely, where the representation is ambiguous, and there are a number of ways that you could have understood the representation, and only some of them are false. Misconception number three, that a claimant can't prove the tort of deceit because of an assumption. So there's some case law that suggests that because the assumption wasn't caused by the representation, it's just something that you assumed on your own account, how could that be the fault of the defendant? Again, Lord Leggett says, not so. Representation and assumption, not mutually exclusive. So the cab driver again. The cab driver may assume that the person hailing the cab will pay, but that belief has still been caused by the conduct of the passenger. Another way to think about it, there will be cases where the defendant exploits an unconscious assumption of the claimant. And by exploiting that unconscious assumption, thereby causes them to act to their detriment. And there's no reason the defendant should escape liability just because that's the way they've done their fraud. Misconception number four, that conscious awareness is required to distinguish between misrepresentation cases and non-disclosure cases. So there's also some case law that suggests that non-disclosure, which of course doesn't give rise to liability, save in insurance contexts and the like, the distinction between them and misrepresentation cases is the awareness of the representation. Not so, Lord Leggett says. He says that we need to distinguish between doing something to cause the claimant to hold a false belief, that's tortious, and merely failing to inform the claimant of a material fact or to correct a false belief. So contrast, molding a property that you're trying to sell. On the one hand, you fail to draw it to the attention of the buyer. That's non-disclosure. That's not actionable. Contrast that with the scenario where you then paint over the mold so that they couldn't see it. In that case, that is tortious because you've made an implied representation by taking the act of painting, namely that there's no mold, and that has induced the false belief. So where now? Obviously, this judgment is an absolute boon for fraud claimants. It's no longer necessary to prove conscious awareness. It's no longer necessary to prove that a particular sense of representation was understood, unless there's ambiguity. And it might sometimes be sufficient simply to rely on an unconscious assumption. There'll now be cases where you can rely solely on the fact that the natural response of the claimant would have been to act to their detriment. There's still some uncertainty, though, in how these new rules will operate. And the one that troubled us most after the judgment was that last one about non-disclosure. There really seems to be a vanishingly small difference between a misrepresentation and a non-disclosure if there's no need for an awareness. If the distinction turns simply on what the defendant has done, in a sense, the cab passenger has simply failed to inform you that she was going to do a runner. The fact that she held up her hand to induce that belief is semantic at best. And I think that that's where we're going to see quite a lot of the hard fighting to be done to work out where that line lies between actionable fraudulent misrep and non-actionable non-disclosure. But we wait and see. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. And thank you to all of our speakers today. You have been watching with Lanny, Grant Nyerston and Antonia Ekman. Please do stay around for coffee and there's more breakfast outside. Otherwise, we'll see you back for the next breakfast briefing in the summer. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Litigation Podcast presented by Blackstone Chambers. Subscribe below to receive our latest episodes. Visit blackstonechambers.com to learn more.